started, but...
So kind of the premise here is that religion and race were very different in the ancient world than they are today. That we think of religion, we think of politics, we think of race as three separate categories. We think of them as things that are distinct and things that are separated, at least in the Western world, in our own context. We think of separation of church and state, we think of separation of ethnicity from religion. In the ancient world, that wasn't so. In the ancient world, religion, race, and your civic identity, the place you saw yourself within the political context, were all enmeshed. And we'll see that from scriptures that are maybe familiar to us, and we'll see how that shapes the formation of early Christianity. But I just want to start with a quote. This is from this book called White Awake by Daniel Hill, who's a pastor out of Chicago. I can pass this around at the end. And it's about his journey of really understanding what it meant for him to realize he was white. And he starts the book with this story of he was at a friend's wedding who was from Southeast Asia. He was an Indian ethnicity, and he's at the wedding, and he comments to his friend that, "I really wish I had a culture like you do." And his friend just looked at him and said, "Daniel, you may be white, but don't let that lull you into thinking you have no culture. White culture is very real. In fact, when white culture comes in contact with other cultures, it almost always wins. So it would be a really good idea for you to learn about your culture." And so this book outlines his journey of learning about his own culture and what it means to be white in America today and to be a white evangelical. And so there's some things about this quote that I think are useful for our understanding of early Christianity and the way that early Christians understood their own identity and how they fit within this broader people of God. The first part is that the identity was hidden for Daniel. He didn't realize that he had a white culture. He didn't realize that that was something. And what this points us to is that oftentimes the dominant culture can mask its own existence. That it's really easy for the dominant culture to act as if that is normal and everything else has to respond to it. And so let's think about Christianity and our assumptions about Christianity. So one of the biggest ones, right, the distinction between Christianity and Judaism. Judaism is particular and ethnic. Christianity is universal and non-ethnic. Right? This is a big assumption. This is, in some sense, the heart of the gospel message. But in other ways, it distorts what the gospel actually communicates. And so we see this as in Galatians 3:28, right? This famous passage when I was teaching, I taught at a Catholic seminary, and so the Catholic students love this passage. 3:28 says, "There is neither Jew nor Greek, neither slave nor free, neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus." Right? And so we read this passage and we say, see, the ethnic distinctions no longer matter. It doesn't exist anymore. But then when we read the next verse, which often gets left out, it says, if you are in Christ, then you are Abraham's children. And the Greek there indicates that it's male children, heirs according to the promise. Now, who are Abraham's children? What people are Abraham's children?
Jewish
people, right? So in a sense, what it's not saying is that all ethnic distinctions are now done away in Christ. What it's saying is that we're all now part of the people of God through God's covenant promise with Abraham. And if you look at Romans, grafted in through the promise of Jesus Christ. And that as non-Jews, we get to participate in this ongoing plan that Jesus culminates of God's purposes in history. And so we get this sense of when we're thinking about Christianity as being a bigger than ethnicity, it's really easy for us to mask our own claim, the own ethnic claims that we make. And so I want to talk a little bit about what it was like in the first century world for early Christians, what that kind of world would have looked like, and then think about what that means for us. So an easy way to think about what early Christianity, or the context of early Christianity would be, is this idea of practical pluralism. So we all know that the ancient world was pluralistic. There's lots of Greek gods. There's lots of people worshiping. We know about Artemis from Acts 19. and the Temple of Artemis and how important that was to Ephesian identity. But this idea of practical pluralism is really helpful because it gives us a better framework, where in the Roman world you could always add a god. You could always worship more gods. No one cared about that. If you thought a god was going to be helpful for you, your family could offer sacrifices. If you thought you needed some extra protection, you could offer offerings to a certain deity for some extra protection. Where you get in trouble is if you start subtracting gods. Because then you're risking making the gods angry, which could bring down God's wrath on your neighbor, on your own family, on your city. And so in a practical context, so thinking about Acts 19 and in the issue in Ephesus, when Paul gets accused of turning people away from worshiping Artemis, the real accusation is that they were afraid Artemis was going to bring down some wrath on the city because her citizens were no longer worshiping her in the right way. And so we have this idea of practical pluralism, and you can start to see the problems that might arise if a non-Jew starts worshiping the Jewish God exclusively through Jesus Christ. Now, we have a very kind of enmeshed patron-client society, so we have this idea that there's a patron, if you think of like the Roman patron, who supports a whole household, who supports all their neighbors. It's a similar model on the divine-human spectrum in ancient imagination, that there's a God who supports God's people. So if we think of the God of Israel in the Old Testament, we think of Yahweh, and Yahweh protects his people. He sticks up for his people. And so this was a common understanding for ancient people in the Roman world that their God would protect them as long as they honored their God in the proper way. Temples were ubiquitous. So if you think of churches in New England or in Colorado Springs, they're on every corner. This is what temples would have been on every corner in the ancient world. And so as somebody who is coming into the people of Jesus, it would be really difficult to avoid participating in temple worship. Not only was it very commonplace, but it was also part of the civic calendar. So if you imagine that every holiday was a religious holiday in the ancient world, that every holiday was like Christmas for non-Christians, and that was much bigger than just a cultural piece, but there were sacrifices that were offered to gods. And this is one of the biggest distinctions between our own context and the ancient context, was when you worshiped your god in the ancient world, you offered a sacrifice. There was some animal or something, blood was shed. And also, we see in 1 Corinthians this issue of the meat offered to idols, that most meat was offered to idols, because if you had an animal that you wanted to sell, you would offer it to the god. And so then you would take, the god would take their portion, which usually was the aroma, and then you would take your portion and sell it in the market, and then a part would go to the priest. So very similar, again, to the system in the temple worship for Israel. So life in the ancient city was difficult. There's no health care. There's no police force. There's no sanitation department. Slavery was very common. Most people, well over 95%, lived barely at subsistence level, so that means they had enough food for the day, but not anything else. And they were at the whims of their patron. And so if a patron's household went under, or there was some issues, or somebody got mad at them, all of that person's people would be in trouble. And they were largely connected through social networks, so associations and trade groups. There's a really interesting inscription of a trade group of fish sellers, and they all gather together and they decide that they're going to set the price for fish in the city, and no one else can adjust the price for fish, and there's like consequences. If you go against this statue or this marble column, then you're going to have to face the consequences. And so we have this, that was the religious and social groups were the way that people protected themselves. That if you died and your family couldn't afford to bury you, a burial society that you were part of, you would have been giving money in, paying your dues, and when you died, you would be able to be buried. And so a lot of Christian groups look very similar to these kind of associations within the city. And religious identity was very tied or very closely connected with ethnic identity and your political identity. So who you were, who your ancestors were, determined which gods you were supposed to worship. And adding God was okay, as I said, but subtracting is not. And so when we think about Judaism, how does that fit within the city? How does being Jewish fit in the city? Well, what's the Jewish ancestral God, right? We have Yahweh. It's the God of the people of Israel. And what are Jews commanded to do with the worship? Worship only Yahweh, right? Only one God. And so because that was the ancestral tradition of the people of Israel, they kind of got a free pass within the city. And so they weren't compelled, for the most part, they weren't compelled to worship all the Greek gods because they were Jewish. Because the Jewish God was their ancestral God. And so because of that, we have this space in the city, if we imagine an ancient civic context, where you have all these Greeks who are worshiping all these gods, and it's a very much part of the cultural life. And then you have a Jewish community that is worshiping their one God, although not with sacrifices, right? Because there's no temple in other cities. They're worshiping their one God, and they're still accepted into the city because they were obeying what their God demanded. And so we have this kind of a two-part system going on within the city. And it's much more complicated than that, but for our purposes, we have two systems kind of operating. And now we're starting to think, what about Gentiles who are in Christ and who are now part of the people of Israel in a particular way because they're worshiping the God of Israel through Jesus? How do they fit within the city? And so I wanted to first highlight a couple misconceptions that people have about ancient Judaism. And so first, three ancient misconceptions that Greek and Roman authors had about Judaism, and three modern misconceptions that we have. So the ancient misconceptions was that Jews were atheists. So with that description of the world, why would we call Jews atheists?
They don't
worship the gods everyone else is worshiping. So they're atheists, they're against the gods. And obviously we know that they do worship a god, but not the gods that everyone else is worshiping. And similar to that, they're accused of being misanthropic, of hating humanity. And so this is really closely connected to that, because if the gods protect the city and your people don't worship the gods, then it's really easy to see how you could be accused of being hatred of humanity. And then the last one is secret rituals, that they have these secret rituals. In some home, there's a really elaborate story of a Jewish community bringing in a Greek slave, buying a Greek slave, and fattening them up a la Hansel and Gretel style so that they can sacrifice them. And early Christians get accused of the same thing. All three of these, actually, they get accused of as well. And so we have these ancient misconceptions. And what about modern misconceptions? The first one we mentioned a little bit, that Jews are ethnically exclusive, that Judaism is only for the Jewish people. And then the second is that it's legalistic or ritualistic. And then the third is that it's centralized or uniform, that there's only kind of one Judaism. So the first one, ethnically exclusive. We have evidence in the New Testament of a couple different ways that non-Jews participated with the Jewish people. So one of those is as proselytes, so they could fully convert. So in Acts 2, we have Jews and proselytes, and then we have a deacon, Nicholas, in Acts 6, who's also a proselyte. So this is somebody who is Greek, and they converted to Judaism. And so it's a non-Jew who becomes, for all intents and purposes, Jewish. And then we also have this people group called God-fearers. And so we have Cornelius is kind of the big one. There's God-fearers in Pisidian Antioch in Acts 13. And these are people who didn't convert, but they were worshiping the God of Jews. But often we don't know whether they were worshiping God exclusively, or this was just in addition to the other gods that they were worshiping. And so this is a much more nebulous category. But we know Jewish communities throughout the ancient world accepted non-Jews into their community in different ways at different times. And so the idea that it was an ethnically exclusive religion, the way that sometimes we construct it when we read the New Testament, is not historically accurate. And so for us, it means looking back at the New Testament saying, actually, is this what the Gospels are saying? And then we have this idea of legalistic and ritualistic. And we often use that as a contrast, right? That's the foil to the Christian grace, that Jews are participating through this legal covenant. They have to do all the right things, rituals. Yet Christians come, they're justified by free grace. And I would say that that construction is actually part of the Reformation more than of ancient Judaism. That it's a Protestant response to a Catholic theology, and the legalistic, ritualistic piece gets cast back into the New Testament as a way of pushing against Catholic theology in response to a Catholic theology from the period of the Reformation. And so we have this idea, a better idea is this idea of what one scholar called covenantal gnomism. So covenant, we know, gnomism just means law. So it's a connection between the covenant and the law for the people of Israel. That God has made a covenant promise with Israel. Again, we see this in Romans 9 through 11. And that that covenant promise is not made void, even if the people of Israel don't follow through with their end of the bargain. The covenant with God, just like our relationship with Jesus, is always one-sided. That God is the only actor, the only one who continues that covenant. And so this is similar for the people of Israel, and again in Romans 9 through 11, we get that image of the people through Jesus, Gentiles are grafted in through Jesus, that God is still maintaining the root of Israel. And then Judaism, the last one, is centralized and uniform, that when we talk about Judaism, we can talk about a single entity. Well, there's a lot of different ways that people practiced Judaism and that Jews lived in the ancient world. There's a big distinction between living in Israel and living in Ephesus or Athens or Rome. And that distinction, one of the biggest pieces is if you lived in Athens, everyone around you is making sacrifices all the time, all of your non-Jewish peers. But you as a Jew would not be able to make a sacrifice because probably you've never been to Jerusalem to make a sacrifice at the temple for God. And so you as a Jew would live a very different way than those around you. And so what's all this have to do with race? What's this have to do with our own context? How are we doing on time? The biggest piece is that we often are blind to the way that our Christianity, in particular Western Christianity, has used Judaism as a foil in order to perpetuate order to build ourselves up against something that is not entirely accurate. And that we create this separation between a Jewish population and between Christians or with Christians in such a way that creates a stereotype, an anti-Jewish stereotype, that gets carried out into our Christianity and then gets carried into our conversations about race today. And so by all that, I just mean when we think about Pharisees, there's a sermon that's on Pharisees. It's never a positive sermon, right? The Pharisees always get a bad rap. Well, most scholars think that Jesus was probably most closely affiliated with the Pharisees, that everyone around him would see Jesus as a type of Pharisee. And so the distinction that we see in context was probably very minimal. Yet when we look at it 2,000 years in hindsight, it's become a chasm that we can't cross. And that we perpetuate or we think about the Pharisees as this ultimate other, rather than those people who were so close to the gospel and just couldn't make that final step. And if we think about this in the context of this bigger piece of Judaism in the first century world, we think about it in relation to, in Luke 4, sorry, Jesus walks into Nazareth, his hometown, takes open the scroll, reads it, prophet Isaiah, and everything's been fulfilled, and then he goes and sits down. And everyone gets really upset at him, right? And they take him and throw him off the cliff. Probably it was a hill. You could think of it more as someone getting kicked out of the city and kind of pushed out rather than they're trying to murder him. But in our own mind, we see this as this big, like, these people rejected Jesus, right? We see this as a culmination of Jewish blindness to the gospel. But in reality, if someone walked into our synod and read a prophecy and said, this has been fulfilled in my saying, we would have some serious questions, right? And we would take that hopefully with a grain of salt, and we try to figure out what's going on with this person, what's happening, you know, but our response would probably not be much different than this community. But when we put that theological piece along with the racial piece, we've created, the history of Christianity has created some really challenging issues that had continued into our own context. And so I wanted you to think about a story, so it's after Christmas, so I can tell this and no one will get mad. So Charles Dickens, right? So Christmas Carol. Think about the character who's the lead character, right? He doesn't celebrate Christmas. He's a miser. His description is very similar to anti-Jewish stereotypes. He makes his people work on Christmas Day, and he has a conversion experience at the end of his life. And this is masked in this great Christmas story that we really love and enjoy, and we love the story of redemption. But it's playing on anti-Semitic and anti-Jewish tropes from the 1800s. And that's one of thousands of examples of things that we've brought into our own culture that we've brought in without kind of seeing how it's come about. And so it comes back to that quote from Daniel Hill that we really need to pay attention to our white culture, and in connection to that, our white Western culture that has brought in some of these ideas about how Judaism fits and how that fits within our understanding of our own identity as Christians. And then the other part of this is its connection to the racial history and slavery in the U.S. and in the world. This book by Willie James Jennings, he's not an Orthodox Christian, I'll put on that. He's a Christian, he's a professor, he's a systematic theologian. But he traces the history of the connection between racism and imperialism, so the spread of European power, and how the racism that comes along with that is really coupled with a theological imagination. That Christian theology actually works with or in that spread of power in a way that allows people to decide that it's okay to begin the process of slavery, and it's okay, it's theologically okay to own other humans, and how that plays out from the Middle Ages until the 1700s, 1800s. And it's just the connection between these two things is really inseparable, and we would just do really well to sit and pay attention. There's another book that kind of takes up the history. This is called The Color of Compromise by Jamar Tisby. And he traces the history of racism in the American church from its founding until really today and into the moral majority. And he has a chapter on Billy Graham, which a lot of people didn't like, and just how his, just the way that he participated in the separation and the things that were happening during the 1960s, rather than standing boldly in certain ways. And so just, again, we can acknowledge the complexity of these issues of saying there are people who are doing amazing things to further the gospel. But if we're blind to this other piece, it's important for us to be able to see it and look back. And then a couple other books that are, I think, resources for just for our own context. So one is a ministry context. So this is called The Next Evangelicalism. And this is written by an Asian American pastor about how the next wave of evangelicalism is questioning some of the Western cultural tropes that it's been given. And so the subtitle is Freeing the Church from Western Cultural Captivity. It's a little provocative. But there's an excellent chapter on race and just how really Western white Christians have understood the church, and they've mapped on our Christianity onto our Western cultural peace. And often it's really easy for us to say something is wrong, something isn't true Christianity, when really it's part of our Western cultural tradition. And it's interesting because it flows also out of the missionary movements of the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s. that those, again, are very coupled with Western cultural's influence, growing influence on the world. And so you just kind of get this cycle that really has perpetuated itself. And then lastly, there's this book called by Letitia Morrison called Be the Bridge. And she's developed a program, its subtitle is Pursuing God's Heart for Racial Reconciliation. And she's put together a year-long program for churches to be able to go through to talk about these issues of racial reconciliation. And our church went through it in Boston just before I left, and so I wasn't able to participate the full year. But I would caution there's a lot of health and goodness that comes out of it, but there's also a lot of pain that comes up. And there's a lot of issues that come up as people of color start to uncover the hurt that they've experienced but never quite able to verbalize it. And as people who live in the majority realize that they actually have a culture and have hurt people just by living the way that they've been able to live. And so it's just a really rich resource, but also creates space for some really challenging things. And for the last few